Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Martha Egan about her new book, La Ranfla, and 8 other New Mexico stories. I'm delighted now to welcome Laura Gabbert and Justin Shine. They are filmmakers whose latest film is the documentary No Impact Man. The film opens this Friday at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe, the CCA. Showtimes and so on can be found on the web at ccasantafe.org or by calling 982-1338. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I love this film. It's such an interesting film. It's about a writer in New York City, Colin Bevin, who decided to take a year of his life to try to live in such a way that he and his family made no carbon footprint at all. That's why it's called No Impact Man. Tell us, what were the first things he did in order to accomplish this?
He had different phases of the project, and Colin is not a trained environmentalist, so he was learning as he went along. So he broke it up into phases. So the first phase was to stop making garbage, basically, as well as, I think, to stop using mechanized transportation. So they could only use self-propelled transportation, by foot, bicycle, push scooter, that kind of thing.
They didn't use the elevator in their apartment building, so they had to walk up nine flights of stairs.
And but the first real phase of the project was this not making garbage. So they did worm composting in their apartment in New York City. They really basically stopped buying anything new or anything in packaging at all. They bought everything at the farmer's market and brought their own bags, of course. Recycled as much as they could, but it was actually pretty dramatic. I mean, Colin weighed all his garbage kind of before the project began and figured out how much garbage they produced in a week. And really, like, by a couple months into the project, they were really making virtually no garbage at all.
And it's interesting because I think Colin wanted to start easy and thought that, making no garbage wouldn't be that, difficult a way to start. And I think he was really surprised at how difficult it is to live without making garbage. So,
and the little waste that they produced, they actually composted, which I you can't really depict a smell in a film documentary, but it probably was not the most wonderful thing to have in a New York City apartment.
No, well, but you did see the flies. Eventually they had a big fly problem that they had to deal with.
Yeah, their apartment definitely had sort of a sweet smell.
How did they cook and bathe and do laundry?
Well, cooking, they didn't dramatically change. I mean, the food aspect of the project was more about food miles in terms of they wanted to eat only locally produced food. They still used their gas stove to cook. They eventually turned off the electricity in their house, so they didn't have a refrigerator or a freezer. So that was a challenge for them. Bathing, they dramatically reduced the amount of water that they used. And I think Michelle eventually, went without bathing for stretches of time. But, and the last question was?
Laundry.
Laundry. Laundry was fun. Laura, do you want to tell about laundry?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, Colin has a blog that he posted on his blog every day over the course of the year-long experiment. And I think one of his readers had suggested that he do his laundry in the bathtub. So he decided to give that a try. And, they would basically, put a few inches of water in the bottom of the tub, let the clothes soak there, and then they would get in there and stomp on the clothes with a mixture of, Castile soap and borax and, basically just, wash the clothes by stomping on them, and then they would, wring them out and hang them. And I know that it was tremendously labor-intensive. It was one of the things that Colin couldn't wait to start using again was his washing machine.
You'd show up on laundry day, and there would be clothing, drying all over the house. It was, kind of took over their lives.
His his wife and daughter were involved as well. His wife, Michelle, was, I mean, I think it's sort of hilarious, and it's one of the great things about the film. You see her in the beginning addicted to shopping, coffee products, and reality TV. And so this was really a stretch for her, and at least in the beginning, not much fun.
That is true. I mean, I think that for Michelle, she says that she decided to do it because Colin was so excited about it, and this is a book idea Colin had, and I think she was trying to be the supportive partner, but I don't think she really knew what she was getting herself into. And I think that for her, the food and coffee were probably the hardest things for her. I mean, she's like a self-proclaimed, I don't know. Kind of baked good and coffee addict. She loves her donuts and loves her coffees and all that. So that was really challenging. And also really enjoyed eating steak and sushi and things like this. So,
yeah. I mean, she was really important to the story for us because, you know, Colin began this already a vegetarian and already, you know, very interested in his place in the environment. And Michelle kind of fulfills the role of every man in the film. I mean, she is skeptical and, like most of us, you know, wants to do good, but is kind of stuck in her habits. And so her transformation is an important part of the film.
And she says at different points things like, "I don't like nature," which is, you sort of wonder, well, my God, how did the two of them get along? But, and we don't, I don't want to give away the whole film either, but it was just so interesting to see the way she changed and to see what their challenges were, because it reminded me of, like, the first time that I went to Latin America, or people who go actually live in a third world country for a longer period of time where there's not a lot of the things available that you're used to. And you just get used to it, and you actually can come to love and appreciate a lot of things about it. But in their case, they did it by choice. And one of the things that's interesting is those choices seem to really touch nerves in people, from skepticism to anger and hatred even. What was going on with that?
You know, I think it's a whole host of reasons. I do think that I think people don't, I think people really resent being told they should give up things that they're used to doing and having. You know, I think that their consumer habits are close to their heart. And, you know, I think that it's challenging. It challenges kind of their notion of what it means to have a good life. And that's one of the central questions in the film. Colin asks, you know, can you have a good life without wasting so much? And what they really discover in a resounding way is yes you can, and in fact their lives improved. They felt like they became better parents, they were happier, they were less stressed out. Michelle was pre-diabetic before the year-long experiment began. She was not by the end. Colin lost 20 pounds, Michelle lost 10 pounds.
They saved a ton of money not buying.
Saved a lot of money, yeah. So there are all these really positive things that came out of living more environmentally. But most of all, I think they really did feel better, and they felt more connected to each other and to kind of what their core values are.
And it's interesting when you think about the what you're giving up when you only shop at the farmer's market and only eat locally produced food, which in their case was basically from New York City to sort of upstate New York and that general area. In other words, things not brought in from 1,500 miles away. That, in some ways, was limiting, because over the winter, they basically had to eat cabbage and root vegetables and things like that.
Sure. I mean, I think that they, in many ways, became much more in touch with their place within nature. And part of that is eating seasonally and, you know, better understanding what the local bounty is. So, you know, likewise, when they turned off the electricity, they became much more in touch with, you know, the cycle of day and night, and, you know, would wake up early and go to bed early. But I think, you know, our bodies are prepared for eating seasonally. I don't think 50 or 75 years ago, you know, we ate pineapples in the middle of the winter, or probably ever on the East Coast. you know. So.
And I think that when I was talking about the benefits, I don't mean to say there weren't hardships along the way, too. I mean, I think that they did get really sick of leek and potato soup every night. And, you know, there were definitely times where they were really frustrated and bored and, you know, kind of fed up with the project. But I do think kind of in its totality, by the end, they were really glad they had done it. And they felt like they had learned some really important things about how they wanted to continue to live their lives.
There is this distinction that is made at a certain point in the film where Colin compares the whole question of, on the one hand, doing without things, and on the other hand, doing with things, but getting them in a sustainable rather than a harmful manner. And I think that's something that is really food for thought for a lot of us.
Sure.
Go ahead, Justin. It's okay.
I mean, you know, in particular, I think he was speaking about electricity in that instance. But, I mean, you know, what he, you know, kind of came to see in a real way was that even when you try to live sustainably, there are all these systems that are set up that kind of prevent you from living sustainably. I mean, certainly living in the city has certain benefits in terms of being able to move around and get your needs fulfilled without driving a car. But, you know, electricity is a perfect example. I mean, he had to sneak a solar panel up onto his roof because I don't think his co-op would have allowed that. And, you know, there are all of these kind of roadblocks to living a more sustainable way.
That is a very interesting thing. It reminds me of there are developments or subdivisions that don't allow you to dry your laundry outside because it's considered unsightly.
Right.
Exactly.
We're talking to Laura Gabbert and Justin Schein about their film, the documentary No Impact Man. So what was it like for you as filmmakers who basically, I mean, I don't know how much time per week you spent with this couple, but you spent the entire year with them, to be filming it, but presumably not really taking part in it? How did it affect you?
Well, you know, we didn't take part in it in the way, in sort of the extreme way that, you know, Michelle and Colin lived that year. But, you know, Colin, No Impact Man, challenged us to make as green a film as we could, and he also challenged us to make changes within our own lives and our own families. And it was sort of hard not to do that. I mean, I think that was one of the really gratifying things about making the film, is as we saw them make these changes and kind of switch over into this other way of living, we saw that it actually wasn't really that hard. I mean, there are aspects of it that were hard, but there are other things like just making less trash or composting or, you know, any number of things that you know, it was sort of exciting to see them do it, and it made me want to try it at home, and hopefully that happens when people watch the film, too. You know, they start looking at their household differently, and they think about what they can do to, you know, have less impact.
Yeah, I mean, Colin was a little bit on the fence about whether he should make the film or not, or whether he should, you know, whether he wanted to participate, and, you know, one of his requirements was that we, you know, needed to think about how we were going to make the film and make sure that we were not following him around drinking bottled water and driving SUVs. So, I mean, we decided to make the film without using any cars, without using any lights. So we had, you know, some challenges that, you know, right off the bat made us aware of some of the things that they were going through.
One of the many things I like about this film is it makes you think about a whole range of things within your own lifestyle. For example, some of the things that they do, you know, we're already doing at home, and probably a lot of other people in Santa Fe are doing to some extent. But, for example, when they get rid of their electricity, they start using these very expensive, probably beeswax candles. And I thought, well, I never buy those because they're so expensive. And then I thought, well, it's a lot less expensive than using electricity. So when you add it all up, things that seem expensive don't always work out that way.
I think there are a number of economic conundrums in living this way. I mean, I think that, you know, shopping at the farmer's market also happens to be expensive, you know. So I think that so the film is not suggesting that everyone can live this way. You know, I think it's showing it's showing different ways one can live, but I think that, as Justin was commenting on before, like, the systems have to sort of catch up to this desire to live more sustainably. And right now you can't, you know, find a lot of locally produced, organic, affordable food in our supermarkets. But hopefully that'll change.
But, and also, you know, Colin also talks about how living sustainably in many ways goes back to just common sense. I mean, you know, using a cloth to clean your house instead of, you know, a million paper towels. Things are just common sense, and common sense that our grandparents, you know, would have, you know, not thought twice about. We've kind of moved into this disposable, you know, economy that really pushes, you know, using something for 5 seconds and throwing it away when it's not, you know, really good for the environment, and it doesn't, you know, it's not necessarily easier either.
The film sheds light on what can be a delicate subject, namely how people's concerns about the environment can sometimes vanish overnight when they have children. And for these folks in the film, Colin and Michelle, Mr. and Mrs. No Impact Man, I suppose, No Impact Man and Woman, having a small child the way they do, without many of the things that are considered, or that some people consider necessary to the health and safety of that child, namely an SUV and all sorts of things like that, the child seems to actually be having the most fun of anybody. And I thought that was really interesting and instructive.
Yeah, I think that Isabella thrived, and I think that she got a lot of more attention from her parents, and I think that she ate better, and all these changes were good for her. And I mean, I think it's kind of, you know, I just think that kids, this makes sense to kids. Living this way makes sense to kids. I have a 5 and an 8-year-old, and they think it makes perfect sense to compost. They don't think that's weird, you know? I mean, it makes sense that you would put it back into the earth and then maybe use it in a garden, and then you would eat the vegetables. And I think that's right. I think that a lot of those conveniences are for the parents. They're not really for the kids.
There's another theme that, again, I mean, I think the brilliance of this film is it gives a lived experience to things that people talk about often more in an ideological kind of way, and that is that when you get rid of your TV and you start spending more time outside and you get to know the farmers in the farmers market and get to know where your food comes from, this sense of your relationship to the world, to the ecological community, to the just your neighbors, to the people around you, really changes. And in this film, you can kind of feel some of the rigidities and boundaries that these folks had just kind of gently and naturally falling away. And it kind of happens by itself.
Yeah, I mean, Colin, I mean, one of the benefits that Colin really reaps from this is being reconnected to a sense of community. And, you know, both in terms of knowing your local farmer, and, you know, having your friends over to play charades instead of sitting in front of the TV all night, but also the idea that, you know, in order to make a real impact on the environment, you have to get involved, and you have to get involved politically. You have to get involved, you know, socially. You know, Colin started volunteering for various environmental organizations to try to create a positive impact to offset the negative impact that we all make just by living. And, you know, he was really moved by joining together with other people who have been doing this kind of thing, you know, their whole lives. So that was interesting.
And I think it makes this, it just opens up this whole set of questions about the personal responsibility and then the responsibility that we have to kind of poke and prod our politicians into taking for actually changing the systems that are out there, which even if all of us stayed home and didn't watch TV and so on, I mean, the world would change quickly overnight, but still political change is necessary, and he makes no bones about that.
Yeah, and I think that's also one of the ways that Colin actually evolves over the course of the year. He's very focused on individual action, you know, at the beginning of the experiment. And as he gets more involved in his local community and in local environmental organizations, he starts really understanding that the onus is on him to also get politically engaged. And so, yeah, and hopefully that happens to people who watch the film, too. You start doing some small things, you know, around the house, and pretty soon you're planting trees in your neighborhood and volunteering for NRDC.
I think one of the things, although it's certainly not the biggest part of the film, but the extent to which the media around him, and including and even especially the New York Times, just didn't get it and had a kind of patronizing and condescending attitude toward him, I thought was really telling. And it's, I mean, what did you make of that?
Justin?
Well, I mean, that was certainly one of the biggest surprises for me. I mean, I think, you know, Colin imagined this as kind of a year apart where he could be in his little eco bubble. And all of a sudden, he got all this attention and became a spokesperson that he never necessarily wanted to be. I mean, he was, you know, learning as he went, and all of a sudden he had to watch, you know, over his shoulder because everybody was looking at him as though he was some kind of, you know, saint. And, you know, it was really interesting to see the reactions. You know, the Times kind of looked at it as a curiosity and, you know, unfortunately didn't take the opportunity to address some of the real issues that Colin was trying to bring up. But in the end, you know, that publicity, even though it was kind of skeptical, it brought a lot of attention to the project and has allowed the project to flourish in ways that, you know, I think Colin is really taking advantage of. And he and we are hoping to, you know, use this as an educational tool to have discussions like this about the way we live. And, you know, so publicity, even when it's skeptical, you know, serves a purpose.
Tell us what you are doing with the film, what you and Colin Bevan are doing with the film. It certainly does have that potential to be taken, for example, to schools and to all sorts of folks.
Well, Colin just had a big no-impact week that I think thousands of people around the country participated in. And we're hoping to, you know, do that in schools and organizations around the country as a kind of teaching tool to give people a little taste of what they went through for a year, and, you know, get them to start thinking and talking about these issues. The film's going to be on television next spring, I believe.
It's out on DVD in January as well.
So, yeah, Colin has created a nonprofit called the No Impact Project. It's noimpactproject.org if you go online. And, you know, with that comes a lot of tools and tips and discussion about, you know, living, you know, with a smaller footprint.
It gives you sort of, guidelines on how you can change things within your home, how you can engage with other, you know, local environmental organizations, that kind of thing. And it's broken down into different categories. It's really quite easy to use and pretty fun.
I found it fascinating and sort of perplexing that in New York City there was this community garden and it had a very long waiting list, but he got with one of the guys who was actually growing vegetables and herbs and so on, and that man is in the film and a very interesting character. But almost all the people in community gardens are growing flowers, and there's very little actual vegetable growing. What's going on with that?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a tide that's turning. But I think for a long time, community gardens have been, you know, places for people to come and sit and enjoy the flowers, and kind of growing vegetables went out of vogue for a while. And I think kind of with the organic movement, that's coming back. Thankfully.
Yeah, it's a good question, though.
Now that the year is over, they are starting to do laundry and washing machines and things like that again. To what extent are they measuring their carbon impact and keeping some of the old lifestyle? Do you know?
Yeah, you know, I think that they consider themselves low impact now, and I think that they're extremely thoughtful about their consumption. I mean, just to give you a few specific examples, I know they still don't use any air conditioning. They have a refrigerator again, but they never turned the freezer back on. They really are still, you know, avid bikers and bike activists in New York City. That said, I mean, they will get on the subway if it's raining or snowing or something like that. I think that most of all, though, they just are, Colin specifically is really devoting his energies to education and outreach on this subject.
I found it fascinating that when asked, what is the most important single individual action that a person could do? And I thought they were going to say something like, turn off your lights or become a vegetarian or something like that. And they said, volunteering with an environmental organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, I know I've heard other environmentalists say that, too. I know Bill McKibben says that, too. And I think that Colin's point is that the engagement with community is really important. And then, you know, the other stuff will follow. But you find community within that. You find like-minded people. You find people who have the same values. And the rest will sort of follow.
What's next for you? Are you working on a new film? Are you going to stay with this project for a while?
Well, and Justin, you should tell him about Mayor.
Yeah, I mean, you know, documentary filmmakers kind of have to have several projects going at once because it takes so long to get done. But one project I'm working on is actually with that community gardener that's in No Impact Man. His name's Mayor Vishner, and he's an old-time activist, one of the original Yippies. So we've been following him and his life and his struggles to get by, you know, in this new age. So that's one film I'm working on. I'm also working on a film about dyslexia that's, you know, part documentary, part animation.
And I'm working on a documentary called The F Word about the state of feminism today. We're really only in the research phases of that. And a fiction project about Guantanamo, about the unlikely friendship between a detainee and his lawyer. So a range of things. And Justin and I are talking about working on other things together in the future as well.
Very interesting. I have to say, the character Mayor, the community gardener guy, the ex-Yippie, was a very interesting character because his political analysis was very sharp, and he pointed out that, for example, Colin's wife was working for Business Week, and basically, I mean, not to go into it in too much detail right here, but some of the contradictions and ironies and things that you have to be really careful of when you are, on the one hand, working in the absolute center of capitalism and kind of trying to change it and not take part in it at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, Mayor was, you know, really important, we feel, to the story because it was important to us to have criticism and to be able to provide, you know, some of that criticism within the film. And, you know, Mayor was somebody that Colin really, you know, cared for and trusted. And to be able to have somebody within, you know, naturally within the film be able to speak so clearly about some of the contradictions, you know, was important to us.
Laura Gabbert and Justin Shine are the filmmakers who made No Impact Man. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And once again, No Impact Man opens this Friday, October 30th at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. They can be found on the web at ccasantafe.org, or you can call them at 505-982-1338. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Martha Egan. Please stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm happy now to welcome Martha Egan. She is an author, and her latest book is La Ranfla and Other New Mexico Stories. And she will be speaking this coming Friday, October 30th at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's wonderful to be here.
So you've written some novels, now you've gone to short fiction. That's sort of the opposite direction than a lot of people do it, I think, isn't it?
Oh, really? Well, I've written stories over many, many years and never really tried to publish them or put them in contests or anything. And I realized that I did have a body of work, and there are... And the stories are specifically about New Mexico, set in New Mexico between the 1920s and present day. And curiously enough, there are a couple of themes that run through these stories. Not in every story, but... Cars, yes. We love our cars in New Mexico.
Indeed we do. And la ranfla is the word, is basically a kind of word for car, or like my ride.
My ride, my classic car, the car that I spend weekends polishing. An older car, could be a low rider. And that term is not understood all over New Mexico among Spanish-speaking people. It actually is probably from the Pachuco era. But it is understood in parts of Mexico, and, you know, it's one of those terms that's kind of here and there.
And so cars is one of the themes in your stories. Now, when you say these were written over a period of years, the first takes place in what, the late 60s or early 70s, and starts in Berkeley, California, during the classic era of war protests and everything over there,
yeah.
Ends up in New Mexico. Did you write that closer to that time?
No.
Okay.
I wrote that pretty recently, and I was never in California. I didn't go to Berkeley or anything like that. It's, you know, just pulled out of the air.
Right, right. Another theme that runs through them is dogs.
Yes. And one cat.
And one cat, yes. So as not to be entirely prejudiced against the lesser species.
Ooh!
It's an interesting process because these, I suppose when you live in northern New Mexico, these local things like dogs and cars and some of the other things, like blood relations is another theme, I think, just come up naturally as part of your writing. Whereas maybe, I suppose there are New York City books about dogs too, but they play more of a role here.
They do. I think, you know, I don't presently have any dogs, but or even a cat, but I have had in the past, and I think they're just a really important part of how we live here, and that's true in other parts of the country as well. But I don't know, you know, the dogs that I've run across here in New Mexico are really characters, real characters.
Well, and I think they can be a symbol for the anarchic and just untamable nature of this area, and by extension ourselves on some level too.
Sure, sure. And there are companions and there are protectors, and they get us out walking on the ditch when we really don't feel like it, and, you know, things like that. Yeah.
One of your stories has a kind of standoff between a property owner and some people whom he basically traps and holds hostage in a cemetery because they opposed him on some little local political issue. And the web of connection among the various people, including the police officers and so on, who are called out to the scene, is really quite comical.
It is. It's fun. And I read it years ago in a much, much more primitive state to a group of people who are mostly from other parts of the country, not New Mexico. And their first comment after I read the story was, well, that's implausible. That can't happen. And I said, oh, yes, it can.
Well, were any of these based on true incidents? For example, that story? I mean, how close to life was that one, that incident?
The bones of it are based on something that actually happened that involved a relative of mine.
No more need be said.
No more need be said.
But that story is called Carnales. Maybe you want to read from it.
Sure. The villagers of Ojo Claro, New Mexico, would long recall with a mixture of outrage and bemused gusto that Procopio, Porky, Lucero, was the first sheriff's deputy to respond to the standoff at the cemetery that steamy Memorial Day afternoon. His wife was one of their own, but Porky, who was from Española, was an outsider. Who knew where his loyalties lay? Porky got the dispatcher's call while he was parked in the San Anselmo Casino parking lot, peeling back the paper on a microwave carne adobada burrito, his third of the day. He knew exactly where the Ojo Claro cemetery was. His wife's ancestors were buried there. Setting the gumball machine twirling on top of his Crown Victoria, he zoomed down I-25 with his siren screaming and took the Ojo Claro exit. At a curve in the old highway that paralleled the interstate, he veered onto a dirt road that was more potholed than surface. The sedan bounded and swerved down the road like a drunken jackrabbit, skidding to a stop in front of the cemetery's high rock wall. There, a big, gutted, florid-faced man wearing a black suit and wide red tie stood pointing a gleaming 30-odd six at the couple dozen mostly old people inside the graveyard. A heavy chain was looped through the bars of the tall wrought iron gate, and an oversized padlock secured it. Porky leaned out the open window of his Crown Vic, draping his meaty hand over the side mirror. ¿Qué pasa, Joe? These people are trespassing on my land, the man yelled, gesturing with the barrel of his rifle at his captives, many of them barely tall enough to see over the stone wall that imprisoned them. Their faces as stony and chiseled as the headstones, the elderly cleanup crew had stopped chopping weeds to lean on their shovels and hoes and glare daggers at the man holding them hostage. Their dark, congealed communal anger contrasted sharply with the sunny holiday and the cheerful decorations on the mounds of their ancestors' graves. Multicolored silk and plastic flowers, some bright and new, some tattered and faded, adorned nearly every plot. Here and there, small, perky American flags fluttered in a light breeze. Put the gun down, Joe, Porky said wearily, pulling on his parking brake and turning off the motor. He unfolded himself from behind the steering wheel and got out of the car, tugging his belt up over his paunch. A siren's mounting crescendo announced the approach of another officer. Porky bent back into his car, retrieved his patrolman's cap, and jerked it down over his thick black hair. It could be his boss, Sheriff McDermott. Porky tucked in his gut in an attempt to look taller, hoisted his pants up again, and asserted his authority. Joe, he said, holding a hand toward the rifle as the sheriff drove up, gimme the gun. You know the cemetery's church property. This place has been a Campo Santo for 200-300 years.
Martha Egan reading from her new book, La Ranfla, and Other New Mexico Stories. You are from the Midwest?
Yes.
And came to New Mexico when you were in, what, your 20s?
No. Actually, I headed out of Wisconsin at 17 and went to school for a year and a half in Colorado, then transferred to Mexico, graduated from college in Mexico.
Then Mexico?
Yes. Mexico City. And then spent 2 years in Venezuela as a Peace Corps volunteer working with microlending. And then I went back to the States. I'm kind of old. That's why this takes a while to tell this story. I went back to the States, worked in Washington for a while, got completely disgusted, and next headed off for Europe on a bicycle trip. And I odd-jobbed and studied and did all kinds of things for a couple of years. And then I wanted to come back to the States, and I came to New Mexico. I'd been here briefly once, and I just thought it was very magical. And it, you know, has a different character than the rest of the country. I think there's more history here. There's the multicultural aspect, which really intrigues me. And just gorgeous countryside, just gorgeous.
And there's something else here too, which I felt in a couple of your stories, which is the way people work out their problems with each other is unorthodox for people who come from elsewhere, and they have to get used to it.
You have to figure out how you get yourself fitted, how you fit into a culture that is not your culture. And I think that's been difficulty for people for hundreds of years. How are you going to fit in? And the people who just sort of think that they can come here from someplace else and swagger in and think that the world is going to open up for them very quickly leave.
So what was your process like in figuring out how to fit in?
Well, I had some entree because my sister and her husband had been in New Mexico for a while, and they started Pachamama, and I went to work for them. And through the store, I met people who continue to be good friends of mine. I also...
Pachamama being a store that sells a lot of imported things from Latin America here in Santa Fe.
Yeah, yeah. We started in Albuquerque, but opened the store here in Santa Fe in 1988, and then I closed the Albuquerque store. So that and just... I think I grew up in a family of 11 quarrelsome people. six brothers and two sisters. And I think, I've been thinking about this, I think you really have to learn pretty early on in a big family how you basically survive. you have to get along. You know right away that you are not the most important person in the whole world, but you also have to learn how to get what you want. And I think I did learn a lot about getting along. And I was in grade school classes with over 50 kids, some of whom did not speak English, some of whose families had just immigrated. And it's just part of the process. And also in Venezuela, you know, there I was working with microlending, but I had to get people's trust because I was handling their money. I had them handle the money as much as possible because it was just too fraught with danger not to do so. But there are certain ways of ingratiating yourself. And in the title story, for example, La Ranfla, this young woman from the Midwest who's followed her boyfriend to northern New Mexico wants to make friends with some of the people. And, of course, things were pretty hostile between newly arrived hippies and traditional populations in New Mexico in the 60s and 70s. I mean, really hot. Some wild stories out there. And she decides that one of the ways to do it is by making banana bread for a neighbor who has seemed to be approachable. And this woman, Felicia, and her husband, Arturo, end up being very, very helpful to this young couple. And this couple helps them. And I think that mutual, exchange of help and everything is how you can survive in a small community. People really need each other in small communities.
Yeah, that's the basis for how things work.
Yeah, yeah.
There is, among other themes in your book, no shortage of very nice young women and super cute boyfriends who come and go and sometimes stay and sometimes don't.
Yeah, I think the West has always been a good place for women, a tough place. But, and entrepreneurial women do well here. In the ranching era, you know, a lot of women's husbands died early because it was pretty dangerous work dealing with cattle and horses and critters and stuff. And women took over. And women have always been strong in the West by default, but also I think the West attracts a certain type of woman. And the women in my stories are very strong women. Some of them have, you know, learned the hard way that their boyfriends are not reliable. And women help each other out, but these are not really women's stories. I think they go across the gamut. And, in fact, in the last story, which is called Granny, the main character is a young guy from the Midwest whose car breaks down on the border in southern New Mexico.
Right. And so that's the one story that doesn't take place in this part of the state. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the stories take place in Albuquerque in northern New Mexico and that one story in southern New Mexico. But I think the stories will resonate with people from all over New Mexico.
Now, that's a question that I wanted to ask you. They resonate probably with people who are from all over New Mexico. What about the rest of the country? Do they have to kind of learn who we are through stories like this?
You know, in other parts of the country, New Mexico has a particular mystique. People are kind of fascinated by our state. People, you know, come here for vacations and fall in love with the place. Some people retire here from other parts of the country. I think there's an attractiveness. And I also think that while the color, I would call it the color and the characters in my stories are New Mexican and very typical of New Mexico, that the basic underlying truths will resonate with people in all parts of the country. But I'm, and the book is distributed all over the country, and I just hope that that, you know, that fascination by New Mexico and the mystique will make it popular elsewhere.
I've been thinking recently about, I had a conversation with somebody about how it was hard for her to sell a very good book that that took place in New Mexico because people at the big publishing houses considered it regional fiction. And I thought, well, everything is regional fiction. If you have a novel that takes place in the suburbs of Connecticut, that's regional fiction.
Yeah, but I think the most parochial place in the United States is New York City, and that's where most of the publishers are headquartered. The publishing business is in a complete state of uproar, as far as I can tell, and I think part of it is that they rely on niching writers and what they're writing, and you know, kind of look down their noses at what they, your friend found, they termed regional fiction. But if it's good writing, I mean, I don't care if the story takes place in Africa or Asia or Manhattan, it will resonate with readers. It's truths, it's quality, and that's my story.
Martha Egan is author of 5 books. The latest one is called La Ranfla and Other New Mexico Stories. And once again, she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore this Friday, October 30th at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been fun.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can find us podcast at the site santafe.radiocafe.org. You can listen to the show there any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience.